Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. This is the final episode of this season. Woo! We got here. This has been the longest season I've ever done, mainly just because brilliant people kept wanting to talk to me and I kept wanting to share their stories. We will be back in the autumn, so don't panic. If you have been enjoying the series so far, you know what I'm going to say, but basically you can rate, review and subscribe. Some of you have already done this. Thank you so much. I genuinely want to say thank you. Like, this season has been a bit special, doing these shows in such weird circumstances, moving to recording remotely, everybody in lockdown, and you've all been so amazing. So yeah, if you've already done it, don't worry about it. Kick back, relax, have some chocolate and a cup of tea and think your job is done. If you haven't and you have enjoyed a particular episode and you just want to tell the world or tweet about it, it really does mean a lot to me. It means I can continue doing the show. Also this, just to say, I don't ever mention it, but there is a way to support me in a different way. If you head to supporter.acast.com/griefcast, you can support the show financially. You can donate anything you like at all. And obviously, you absolutely don't have to do that. But if you would like to support the show that way, that means a huge amount to me. And I'll be honest, lots of you have been doing this and I didn't really understand how to log in properly. So I only just discovered that not only have you been donating so generously, you've also been leaving me messages, which I've just found. So thank you so much. I genuinely mean it. It's I'm gonna get sentimental now, guys, but yeah, I started this show 5 years ago and I'm a bit stunned that we're still here and people still want to have these conversations and are still opening up and that you guys are still willing to listen to them. And I know this year has been shit, shall we say. So I really, really appreciated having the Griefcast to come back to give me a focus and a community to come back to when it's all got a bit much. So thank you in whatever way you've supported me, genuinely. And if you don't want to or you've done it already, don't worry about it. No problems. Thank you. This week is also a special episode. It's the first time I'm speaking to a brother and a sister. Our guests this week are the brilliant Stephen and Anita Mangan. You'll probably recognise Stephen. He's been in many, many brilliant television, theatre, comedies, dramas, all sorts of things. You may recognise him from Green Wing or The Jeeves and Wooster or The Split, which he's in currently, or Alan Partridge. I mean, honestly, his CV is ridiculous. He's been in so many things. He also happens to be an incredibly charming and wonderful, funny, lovely person as well. And he runs in the family. His sister is a graphic designer and illustrator. And also a wonderful person, and they have collaborated on a new book called Escape the Rooms. You'll hear Stephen talk about it. It's kind of aimed at sort of like 9 to 14 year olds, but I loved it, says my mental capacity, but I loved it. It's such a brilliant book, and it kind of deals with grief in one of the best ways, I think, for children's books, actually, because the two main characters have experienced grief, but it's kind of like under the surface. And if you are someone who was bereaved when you're young, you'll know how much it kind of is there and isn't there at the same time. It's out now, published by Scholastic, and yeah, it's such a lovely book, and Anita's illustrations are so funny, and yeah, I really loved it. So definitely recommended by Griefcast. Stephen and Anita came in to talk to me about their parents. Their mum passed away when they were in their early 20s, and their dad passed away 15 years later. So Anita and Stephen, who are we remembering today?
Both our parents, actually, mum and dad.
Okay.
Mum died 30 years ago. Dad died 16 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
So who's the older?
Me.
He is.
Steve. By a year. Can you tell? We're by our voices. We are, very close. Only 14 months between us. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's super close. So how old were you, Stephen, when you're... Mum died.
Mum was young. I mean, she had me when she was 22, I think.
Wow.
So she died at 45. I was about 22, I think, when she died.
Wow.
Oh, was that right, Anita?
Yeah. You were just 21, Anita.
I was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've got a younger sister, Lisa. So yeah, we were reasonably old considering she was only 45. Mm. We were lucky, I suppose, that she'd had us young my youngest, I didn't have him, but my wife had him when I was nearly 50. So,
wow.
So we were in our early 20s. I just left university and was sort of wondering what I was going to do with my life. I trained to be a lawyer, and that was never going to happen, I think. But, and Anita, you were, I don't want to speak for you. What were you doing at the time?
What was I doing? I was, I'd lived in Spain for a couple of years, and I was back and working at Comic Relief. That's what I was doing. Yeah, I hadn't long started there. And yeah, so I was there, very, very supportive group of people. It was very small in those days as well. Yeah. There were only 17 of us that worked there. So it was like a extended family. So it was lovely and very helpful. Yeah.
And so what did she die of? What happened?
She had bowel cancer. Oh. I mean, she was incredibly healthy, you know, didn't smoke ever. I think she probably smoked one cigarette in her entire life. Didn't drink much, ate well, exercised, looked, you know, was fit and healthy to all intents and purposes. And I was having dinner with her one night, just the two of us at home, and she got up from the table and went next door, and I found her a few minutes later. She was doubled up in pain. The doctors didn't think it was anything serious. We had, you know, she went in for an operation, and then she was in there for hours, and we came out, the doctor came out to speak to us, and do you remember, he couldn't look us in the face. He was sort of looking at the ground, and we were thinking, this doesn't sound like it's going to be, everything's fine, she'll be back home tomorrow kind of speech. And she had bowel cancer and was dead 6 months later.
Oh my God, that's so fast.
So
what I remember about that that moment in the hospital as well is just, I think I just didn't believe it at all. I just refused to believe it. I remember that so clearly. Only, you know, even all the way through her illness, I just refused to believe that this was going to end badly. In denial, maybe, is the expression, but and not realistic about it. And it was only when she died I thought, okay, this is real, this is happening. And but I just remember that moment in the hospital. You do remember those moments, don't you? The key moments.
It's so it's so common. I speak to so many people who say, you know, we just couldn't take it in, we just couldn't believe it. And I think it's interesting, my dad was 44 when he died of pancreatic cancer, but they found it in the liver first, so he got both. And same, very healthy. He had smoked and drunk, like he'd enjoyed himself as a young man, but he was like training for an Ironman and was like running triathlons and marathons, and that same thing where everybody's a bit like, what? And I think it's quite hard when someone's young and they look quite healthy and that, you know, no one's been worrying about them. You know, that kind of like, sometimes you get like a person, you're like, oh, everyone's like, oh yeah, they're not very healthy, are they? Like, they're in that category where everyone's like, oh yeah, they're fine. And if they suddenly, the word cancer gets used, you can, it's really hard for your brain to go, what? How is that in that person when they're fine?
Yeah. And the person who's supposed to be looking after you and you're not supposed to be, this is not supposed to be happening at that point. I mean, I think cancer, if you're young and healthy and your cells are dividing quickly, I think that's not, it's not very helpful, is it? But yeah, it's just a total shock, really. Although, I mean, her mother, my our grandmother had died at 47 of cancer. Her father had died at 63, I think he was. So, you know, they were sort of in the family and it was around. And her mum, I was the first grandchild to be born, and so I was, my mum was pregnant with me when my grandmother died. But yeah, it's, but that was sort of back in the 60s in rural Ireland, you know. I mean, she had an awful time. My grandmother apparently had paracetamol. That was the drug that she had.
Oh my god.
For her womb cancer. That's all she had. And our two my mum's youngest siblings, Alan and Bridget, who were 9 and 11 at the time, they just remember her just on the bed, you know, with literally paracetamol and last stage cancer and horrendous pain and absolutely no medical help at all. And then Bridget came to live with us. She was sort of like our older sister. And Alan went to live with our uncles down on the south coast in Chichester. And he died. I mean, that was our first experience of grief, really, was Alan, wasn't it? Our first sort of bad, you know. He horrible story. He was in London working for his sister, Bridget. But it was his youngest son's third birthday. And he was racing home from London to get back in time for his son's third birthday and had a car crash on the way back died. Age 27.
Oh, my God.
So that phone call that we got in the middle of the night.
That was the worst.
I mean, I think, you know, a death where there's an illness and things start to get worse and you start to realise what's coming is one thing, I think. And then the violence, the emotional violence of a sudden thing like that, a 27-year-old man. And we all had to, we got a phone call. I remember it in the middle of the night, it was probably about midnight. We all had to pile into the car and drive round to Bridget's. And that, you know, Alan and Bridget were really close after all they'd been through in Ireland together. And, you know, I remember driving up to our house and her seeing our car and going, is that Mary's car? Is that, that's my mum's name, our mum's name. Is that Mary's car outside? And knowing that we were going to have to tell her something.
And she was pregnant.
She was pregnant.
Oh, yeah.
Tell her something that would effectively, you know, change the course of her life.
And,
That was really, really hard. And that whole aftermath of that, Alan's death was, we all went down to Chichester and hung out with, they were all big, we're big Irish families. Mum was one of seven, dad one of nine.
Wow.
So we sort of, and you know, which is great at a time like that because there's so many people around, there's so many people to share it with and to be around and just sort of sit in rooms with all these aunts and uncles and cousins all in a similar state of shock and, you know, disbelief.
And so death was kind of, and this is my experience of talking to people who do have Irish families, is that it's not hidden away. Like when something happens, the children, like you said, they get in the car, they go get deliver news as much as, which is very different from people brought up in a much more, you know, traditionally English, you know, stereotypical cliched. Obviously, not everyone experiences that. But you were very involved. You knew people were talking about Alan. And
I mean, it was the same experience when Mum was ill. Our house was, it was full of people. And when Dad was ill, you know, every night we'd have to go to Sainsbury's. I don't know why I remember these things, to buy more chocolate puddings. But it was all about everyone was there for dinner. Whoever was around just stayed for dinner. You know, Stephen would get his guitar out. Am I allowed to say this, Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, that does sound like I took the opportunity of having an audience in the house. Look, while you're all here, I've been workshopping a couple of numbers.
by the rivers of Babylon.
This one is 28 minutes long and it's called Me and My Talent.
But no, it's just a collective, you know, family time, and there would be laughter and there would be, you know, giggling and there would be crying and there would be, yeah. And I think that's just a close family thing for, you know, for us and for lots of people. And it's so helpful.
God, I think it's so interesting because, like, you know, I try and speak to people from all sorts of backgrounds, but I have spoken to, I would say, a higher number of people from Irish backgrounds because they're so willing to talk about it and they're so comfortable with it. And they also, we do live episodes with three comedians. And I remember a particular episode, we had an Irish comedian called Gráinne Maguire. Brilliant comedian. And there was, I think he's British Indian, and comedian Ahir Shah. And he was saying, oh, I've heard this thing that obviously is not true, that you have like the body in the house with you. I'm like, what a weird thing to say about Irish people, right? And she was like, what? It's true. And I remember his face just being like, I thought that was something mean people said about Irish people, like, of course they wouldn't do that. And she was like, what? And Gráinne said this such lovely thing which really stuck with me. It was like, how rude not to invite them to the party. She was like, it's for them. And I found that, like you said, I think it's really helpful because it's just something you don't, it never seems to be in Irish culture a thing that's shameful or hidden. Mm. It's like death is like, no, it's very normal. It's very, we
it's so
talk
common.
About it, we share it.
It's so common. I mean, it's just, there's so many people and, you know, I think our grandmother on my dad's side had 11 children, but only 9 survived. And the younger, the last one she had, because she was a bit older, she was in hospital and they would take the babies away every evening and bring them back out to the mothers each morning, and all the babies were brought out in the morning and given to each of the mothers in the ward, and no baby was brought to her, and she was like, where's my baby? And the nurse said, didn't anyone tell you it died in the night? You know, it's that kind of, I mean, not flippancy, but just it's
part of life.
It happens.
It's very
it
close.
Happens a lot.
Yeah, when it's that close, then it, of course, it becomes discussed. So with your mum, was she able to talk about her death? Did you have those conversations before she died, or was it too painful?
Not really, no. I think she was in, I think she was trying to hang on to her own hope. And I think she was conscious of her position as sort of the mother, and I think she was obviously worried about us and trying to, I remember Bridget asked her at one point, how do you feel? And Mum said, how do you think I feel? And that was about the closest she got to sort of, you know, sort of snapping or I don't know how she did it, but she didn't talk about it, not to us anyway. I don't know whether she did to Dad or not, but not to us.
It's so hard, isn't it? I've you know, obviously spoken to so many people, but my dad refused to talk about it, just refused. And at the time, obviously I was 15, so that a little bit younger, and I was very angry anyway. And it just added to the fury. But now I'm much older, I think, oh god, of course, how can you talk about it to your, you just don't want it to be true, you just don't want it to be true, you know? So how do you begin that conversation with your children? It's so difficult.
Well, all the language around it as well, the battle, you know, I'm going to battle it, I'm going to beat it, I'm going to win, you know, this is kind of myth that, you know, if you're strong enough and fight hard enough, you can win the battle. Whereas, of course, you know, if you see it happen, it's a process you go through, it's a medical process you go through, and I'm sure a state of mind could well have an impact, but it's not a battle, you know. Some people, you know, like Mum, by the time they found Mum's cancer, it was in her liver already, a very large tumor in her bowel. There was no way she was going to come back from that. It just was discovered too late. You know, if she discovered it earlier, the process of radiotherapy and chemotherapy might have worked and she might still be here. But it just happened too late. And I suppose that denial as well, the symptoms thing. I mean, we're big advocates of getting yourself checked out because you really want to find out before it's too late. I mean, we go and have a camera shoved up there every few years. The actress Geraldine James put me onto St Mark's Hospital do a sort of family cancer unit, and they're you know, looking at bowel cancer and if it's genetic and stuff. So we're on that program and we get tested, and it's pretty, I mean, it's not the best day out, but but you know,
it's very helpful.
Better to know early.
Oh, God. Yeah. And I think, so my husband, both his parents died of cancer, and sort of my dad died of cancer. And I think you enter this world of, it's not hypochondria, of it's like the death anxiety. We've also used that phrase on the show, of like every single ache and pain is like, well, okay. And you are, you know, you do, you're like, I'll get it checked out. We've had so many tests on things. And you can see sometimes medical professionals, obviously it's a very hard job, but they'll, you know, sometimes people are lovely and sometimes they're like, ugh. And you're like, no, I won't be embarrassed because it was found too late in my parents. So yeah. I'm going to get every test going. Because
yeah, absolutely.
I saw what happened when people got shoved away by people making them feel that they were making a fuss, you know. And yeah, it's
but I'm convinced I'm going to live to 90. I mean, I don't think it's going to get me. No way. I mean I may be totally delusional, but I think, yeah, I actually feel I might never die.
All right,
I've just got a feeling today, anyway, I've just got a feeling that maybe I'll just dodge that.
That's really interesting, because what's happened to me is I am so terrified. I just think, because it was very sudden, I guess maybe I was younger.
Just terrified of cancer or terrified of just death in general?
Death in general. Cancer's definitely one you've got to watch out for. I think everyone's going to die. Like, I've got that. Like, as soon as someone says to me something like, oh, yeah, so-and-so's mum's not very well, I think, oh, they're going to die. Like, I'm very like,
do you say that to them?
No, but when they, like,
you're then the good be time like, reassuring friend.
I know and then, but if they say like, oh, so and so's mum's got cancer, and you know what most people want is like, you know, but they're gonna battle it, they're really strong, and I'll be like, okay.
I know, because it, I just
can't
me too.
I can't do the kind of, yeah, I can't believe this battle of it, because I know that's not true. Like, my dad was like an ox, you know, he was such a powerful, positive person, all that. Very good mentality, very good positive thinking, and it killed him. And so I think I can't help but be like, sometimes people just die. But I think that's great, Stephen, if you feel like immortal. I think that's great. Like,
I mean, no,
more
I do. I very much live with the knowledge that this won't last. But that I'm sure you've talked about this a lot on this podcast. But it's what you do with that knowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, you either live in denial and just pretend nothing's ever going to happen bad, or you accept that we've only got a certain amount of time and you might as well get on with it. I mean, mum's death changed my life, because I decided to become an actor, you know, during that whole process. And I think my audition for RADA was 10 days after her funeral, or 10 days after she died, which is actually, in retrospect, the best time to do an audition, because there's nothing more attractive in an actor who doesn't give a flying whether they get in or not. There's something very liberating about that. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it as a tactic for important auditions, but it made me think, if her mum was 47 and my mum was 45, then wow, I might have 20 years, so let's ditch the law. Who am I kidding? I'm never going to be Rumpole of the Bailey. One for the kids.
But you want to play Rumpole of the Bailey. That's
I want to play. And in fact,
yeah,
I am now playing a barrister. I'm literally playing a barrister in The Split. We're about to start filming next week. So I get to be a lawyer and wear makeup. So I get to do both.
It's the dream. It's the absolute dream. I think that's really that feeling. We've talked about it on the show. I always describe it as the fire. So it's like, I think I found roughly, and from talking to people, the first 5 years after a parent dies, you're a little bit untouchable, like, because you just don't care. You just don't care anymore about all this stuff that had seemed so important has just disappeared. And I was definitely, I was that feeling, like you said, it's a weird feeling. It's not, you wouldn't choose it, but it is one good thing that happens in this like shitstorm, is that you're sort of quite powerful, because your vision of what the life means and what you need to do is quite clear. Did you have that, Anita? Did you kind of have this moment of like, okay?
I think I've had it ever since, and particularly after Dad died, just that thing of, we really don't, you know, we really might not have that much time, so I'm going to fill my life and I'm going to do anything I want to do. And I've literally just, I mean, I trained to be a graphic designer and illustrator at 31. So that was 5 years before Dad died. But I just thought, I can do anything. Yeah, I just fill my day, and I'm very positive about life, and I enjoy myself as well. I just make sure I do things I enjoy. And I suppose that's also a symptom of getting a bit older. You've always done things you enjoy, haven't you? I have always done things I enjoy.
I mean, you've been very good at that. It's very admirable, but you've always done what you wanted to do. And
yeah, I mean, I didn't really know what I wanted to do for a lot of the time, but I do enjoy what I'm doing at the time, apart from 3 days temping with a travel agent called, I won't name him, but it was the worst 3 days ever because it was so horrible. But that's the only time I've been unhappy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I talked, people who've lost parents young, it shapes you. There's no denying about it. It shapes you. And then how do you... This is something I always find interesting, is that it shapes you sometimes in a positive way, but there's this weird tension because it's come from such sadness. So you have this life where you're like, oh, I really know what matters. I really know what's important. And if I'm scared of something, I do have a really like, fuck it. Like, what's the worst that can happen? If I'm embarrassed, fine, I'm not dead. But then you know this comes from this sort of really painful thing. So it's like trying to hold... Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying it very well. That tension of where it comes from. And sometimes you're sort of pleased that you have that. And then also, like, people go, wow, you just don't care. Or you do this. And you think, yeah, because my parent died.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. It's a positive thing, but it comes at a great cost. I mean, what is life but literally dealing with the stuff that's thrown at you? I mean, that's kind of it, isn't it? And some people... I always feel grateful that we had parents who were so warm and loving and smart and interesting, and you know, they loved each other, they loved us, we were a very happy family, and yes, they died early, but you know, there are people who have horrendous relationships with their parents all the way through their childhood, and the parents live to be 172 and they hate each other for each one of those 172 years. I mean, I got 22 years with mum. I mean, the hardest thing for me to deal with is the kids, them. You know, she never met Louise, my wife. She never met our children. And I never got to know her as an adult. You know, I really sort of knew her as a child. And you wonder, that thing that happens when you get older and you start to see your parents as people rather than your parents.
Yeah.
And you start to see them as, you know, for all the good and the bad and the complexity of them. We sort of never really got to that point. So...
We got to that with Dad. You know, there was a real shift after Mum died of us all of a sudden, you know, we were friends with Dad rather than him being the disciplinarian and the head of the family sort of thing. And we had a great time with Dad. And he really just, after Mum died, it sounds like he's just like, he went, you know, he wanted to go on holiday a lot. Yeah, she's dead, let's go on holiday. He took us away a lot. You know, he's sort of like, we've got to travel. He travelled the world, didn't he, Stephen? He just thought, life is too short. Those were the moments he should have been spending with Mum doing that, because we were all about to leave the house.
They're about to get rid of us all finally from the house and be able to do what they wanted, but...
He was so adventurous, and he thought, well, I'm not going to waste any time. I'm going to do all these things, and we're so glad he did, because then, you know, 15 years later or whatever it was, he died. So,
and did he die of cancer as well?
Yeah, brain tumor.
So, again, 6 months from diagnosis to death.
Really?
So, for a very similar kind of time period, he developed severe headaches and, you know, wonder what it was. Got a diagnosis in February, I think it was, and died at the beginning of September. So yeah. Ugh. So again, a short period of time, and again, I was lucky to be around to help look after him. In fact, we were filming the second series of Green Wing at the time, which was really bizarre. Filming in a real hospital all day, and then going to visit my dad in another hospital in the evening.
Yeah.
But they shut down the whole production of Green Wing for 10 days so I could be there with him at the end, which is unheard of. And people wouldn't do that now, but they were very, very considerate. But yeah, he was 63, which again is just too young. And considering he's one of, you know, he's the sixth child of nine, and all the rest of them are still happily, you know, I'm happy to say, very healthy and well. He just unlucky, you know.
He was. I remember thinking that after Mum died, you know, just Dad's going to be okay because he comes from, you know, his family history was really positive. Yeah. His dad died at 92, his mum at 89, all really healthy. And I thought, oh, well, you know, he's from kind of healthier stock, as it were.
I know, it's so crazy. My dad, both his parents, well, my grandpa died 6 months after my dad, but really because my dad had died. And my grandma lived to, I think she died just before her 100th birthday. And it's so, you know, that's what's interesting with the genetic thing, because, you know, obviously if you're anxious and you're worrying about it, sometimes you're looking for something that doesn't make, that there is no sense to it, because my dad has, you know, two older brothers who are still here, still healthy, absolutely fine. It's just, there's no fucking rhyme nor reason to it. And so much of grief is, I think sometimes with the death, is just coming to a peace with that, of like, people just die and there's no, you know, you can't pin anything on it. You can't, but so much of life is about going, oh, that happened because of this and I did this and this is what makes sense. And it's like, people just die. That's just, the body just doesn't always do what you want it to do.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. How was that after your dad? Like, I've spoken to a lot of people about, once both parents are gone, there's another change in your life of like, oh, okay, it's me now. Did you sort of feel that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when Mum died, you could look to Dad to sort of lead the way. Yeah, and then when Dad died, that's kind of it. It was just us. We're the next on the conveyor belt. We're the sort of most senior people. But again, I say that, but we're very close to our uncles and aunts, and there's a lot of them. I mean, we have something like 52 first cousins or something like that.
Wow.
So, you know, there's plenty sort of big eyebrowed, curly haired, toothy people out there who you could turn around and go, you know,
but that makes us sound like there's anyone with big eyebrows and teeth. What, we're just going to go and grab them and say, help me.
That's what got me through.
You must be related to me.
Yeah, I mean, surely. But yeah, you know, I mean, but I think by then, I think that process, like I said before, the emotional violence of someone, a knock on the door and the policeman saying, or somebody saying something terrible has happened, compared to that bit of time to start getting your head around it and to start grieving ahead of the event. And obviously we'd been through it once, so we started to, I mean, I don't know if it'd be interesting, Anita, that's the denial thing. Did you feel it again with Dad?
No. Not then. And also, you know, being sort of that bit older as well. I was definitely, you know, and you saw his demise as well. And so, no, I did take it on board the second time.
But we sat, I mean, after he died, we phoned our uncles.
Oh, yeah.
Who came to the house, to the two of them who lived nearby. And then over the next 24 hours, we kept him there. And one by one, his brothers and sisters turned up, and one by one, you go to the front door and greet them, and, you know, have that sort of awful moment, and bring them in, and and we just all sat around for, you know, a whole day.
Yeah.
Just, you know, maybe 15, 20 people in that room, just talking and crying and laughing, and, you know, it was a very much a shared experience. It was. Mm. It wasn't. I don't know. I don't know whether other people would find that odd, an odd thing to do. You know, that once someone's died, you want to sort of get rid of the body, but it didn't seem right. I kind of wanted, or we wanted, everyone to have a chance to say goodbye and to share in that moment and share it with us and each other. And so that's what we did. And I'm glad we did. I think it was really healthy and a useful thing to do. I mean, we're just so used to being from a big family. My dad worked with his brothers and sisters. I'm now working with my sister on this book.
Yeah.
My mum's brothers all work together. I mean, they're all builders, both families, my mum's and my dad's family. My mum's family were all builders down the south coast. They all worked together. Dad's Finsbury Park, you know, they all had a building company together. So it's just inbuilt into us that family is where you turn to at moments of any stress or problems or difficulties, and that they're there for you, and you don't have to ask, and you don't have to explain. And we still, I mean, I still go back to Ireland when we can. Obviously, things have been different the last year or two, but every summer there's a week or two in August where we all go back, and there's sort of dozens of us descend on this little town on the west coast of Ireland, and clog up the bars and the beaches and shelter from the rain. But you know, that's the thought of being, you know, when a funeral, when there's two people there, or not to have sisters or brothers or cousins or uncles to share any of that with. And I know a lot of people go through these things on their own, and to me that's almost more difficult than the idea of going through it in the first place. You know, life is going to throw all this stuff at you, but at least we have a big group of us who can help absorb the impact together, and that's priceless.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. I think it's, I mean, obviously, as you said, you can come from a big family and everyone can hate each other.
Yeah, true.
But like, it sounds like you're, you know, it's a big family that's full of love and everyone likes each other and makes an effort with each other, because obviously these things don't just happen because you're related. You have to make effort to care for people. And I think, I think it's a really lovely, lovely thing. And I think definitely keeping the body and just having people around, there's something about it that just makes sense for us as the animals that we are, as humans, if that's, you know, that's what needs to happen. And obviously, you know, not everyone can have that. Like, you know, sometimes people die in hospitals or, you know, they don't have the family anymore. And yeah, my dad, he died in hospital, and similar, you know, then various people came into the room. We just sort of kept him in the room and people kind of came in and came out and did goodbyes that way. And it definitely felt like the right thing to do for us. And oh yeah, every family is completely different, but what you're describing sounds nice. That's what I think I'm saying. Of like a big unit and all those people. And I think what's so great is that you don't get plunged into the grief like cold water straight away, do you? Because it's like there's people, you have to make tea, you have to talk to someone, then you cry, then you're laughing. And it's that kind of bustle keeps the grief just from hitting you in the face straight away, which I think might be helpful. Yeah.
You don't feel alone. Mm. You know, and death is the process of someone going and leaving you.
Yeah.
And it's an absence, isn't it? Sudden. So to lessen the loneliness, to share in it helps with it, I think. I mean, when Mum died, there was 10, 12 of us in that room.
Wow.
And I mean, some good comedy as well going on. We were standing, because obviously my parents are Catholics, Mum especially devout, and we were saying the rosary, Hail Marys.
Hail Marys.
Which you take it in turn to say a verse each, and our cousin kept forgetting when it came to his turn what the words were, and his dad, our uncle, kept getting really cross with him, and it was absolutely hilarious because the build-up as it went round the room one by one, we'd done it about 80 times, so God knows why, but in his grief he couldn't, and every time it got to him he kept forgetting the words, and it was just great, really funny. But you know, we were lucky, they both died at home because Marie Curie nurses, you know, I'm an ambassador for them now, because thank God for them. They uh, they provide nurses and who come and help you, you know, help the patient be at home. So mum and dad both died at home in their own beds, surrounded by their families.
That was a slightly funny moment with when dad was dying.
Yeah. Oh, the nurse.
The nurse going, "He's gone." And me and my sister going, "No, he hasn't," because he was still breathing. I'm just going, "No, he's gone. He's gone." She obviously knew it was imminent. We were like, "No, he hasn't."
Well, also and the moment he died, you know, it was getting really dramatic.
Mm.
And it was literally just about, I think he was just about to die and the door burst open. The nurse said, "Anyone want a cup of tea?"
Oh, God.
We were like, "Not now, thank you.
Not now.
Not right now.
Read the room. Read the room."
And I think he died about 8 seconds later.
Oh, he's waiting. Perhaps he was waiting for someone to...
Maybe, yeah. For a cup of tea.
Yeah. I think, that it's funny, isn't it? Because, you know, if you have watched someone die, the breathing slows so much. And we definitely had that. My brother was like, "Mum, is he gone?" She was like, "No."
Like,
then they
tell,
take one more breath and you're like, but you're sort of like watching as if it's like some bet you're waiting for, you know, like, "No, still going. Yeah. Okay." And then you all kind of, "Oh, right, we've got five more minutes here."
I really hope that, you know, the person dying hears that as their last thing. Yeah. Has he? No, not yet.
They'll be like, I you'll know, guys. You'll know, okay?
I'll do it. I'm right here.
I mean, those moments are, yeah, blissful, because the rest of it is so fucking awful. You know, that's why I always tell people when I speak to listeners who say, "Oh, well, I feel so bad, this happened." I'm like, don't feel bad, because the grief is so shit. If there's a bit of laughter in it, like, that's the gold that you sort of have to hold on to, because the rest of it's shit.
Yeah. I mean, and why can't there be?
Yeah.
Who says there can't be funny moments?
Oh, God.
Of course there are. I mean, I'm slightly obsessed by undertakers and, you know, because they must come into work on some days on a real high, just fallen in love, or so, you know, they've won the lottery, they've won 60 quid or something, you know, something exciting has happened to them.
Yeah.
But of course, they've got to get the game face on, which is somber. But
poor undertakers. That's who.
Backstage real... undertakers. That's,
yeah. The stage
that's
managers.
My next sitcom.
I'd watch it, Stephen. I'd watch it. How have you kept them alive for your children? Like, is that? Do you talk about them? Are you very sort of open that they're, you know, they, you know, granny and granddad
really
are
hard.
Dead?
It's like, really hard. I mean, Mum died 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've got a 5-year-old. Who you know, and he's got one grandparent alive, his grandmother, my wife's mother, and it's very hard for him to conceive of the concept. Even my 13-year-old, my oldest, it's very hard, you know, from photographs. Obviously, there's not really any video because we're so old. It's just difficult.
There is video somewhere, but we can't find it, can we? We've got Mum. We used to do these little scenes, like recreate adverts when video cameras first came about. Dad had one for work and we nicked it for a while and recreated the Pepsi challenge and all sorts of stuff. And we got Mum to act in one of them, you know, to tell us off holding a wooden spoon. And I don't know where that video is. I mean, where is it? We neither one of us know.
We talk a lot about that on the show, because I'm the same as you, if you're an analogue griever. So, like, everything is, like, not to hand. Whereas the digital lot have, like, they just pick up their phones and they've got voicemails, voice memos, thousands of photos. But the analogue lot are like, I think it's in that attic. No, we took it out of there, didn't we?
Here's a picture. She had an Irish accent. That's all about all I've got for you.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of, I mean, I'm saying, because my dad would be... I think I'm 22 years now, 23 years. I've lost count past 20. And it's very hard to conjure up that person. I think all you can do is the stories. I think the stories are such great character portraits, aren't they? But say my daughter's 4, and so, yeah, she'll just say things like, "Oh, well, because your dad's dead. Your daddy's dead." And I'm like, yep, that's where we're at with that. Okay.
Or your mummy's in Devon, as my 5-year-old said to me. I was like, if she's in Devon, that is serious news.
But yeah, it is hard. It is hard, especially when it is a long time ago. But I guess the main thing I've tried to do is not hide it, you know, like, just they're dead. That's it. So that when they do get to hopefully an older age and they can say, "Oh, right, let me see that picture. Let me imagine. Let me ask for that story." But not, and you hope they'd be comfortable to ask that because they've seen you be comfortable talking about them.
Do you take them to the graveyard?
Yeah, obviously I don't have a graveyard to take because we cremated my dad and then scattered the ashes. And funny enough, at the time, thought it was a great idea. But after talking to people for 5 years, bloody graveyards are bloody brilliant. Like, I just think that like, you've got somewhere to go and it doesn't, that place doesn't move, yeah. You know?
I mean, it doesn't feel like them though because they only went there once and they were, in a box. True. It's not really... it doesn't bring them back. I think it's partly the reason we go to Ireland is because that feels like the place where they are. But yeah, I mean, they are buried in North London, our parents. But it is somewhere we can go together on those days and meet up with people and then go for a cup of coffee or whatever. Mm. But
And the subject is not taboo, definitely not.
Yeah. No.
And my daughter's now 17 and I've got a 14-year-old boy. And she asks about them, you know. I mean, she was the only grandchild as such. She was alive when my dad was alive, but she was 18 months old, so she doesn't remember him at all. And he adored her, and you know, he'd walk her around his flat, kind of carrying her, showing her things like the window locks on his windows. And I was thinking at the time, why would she be interested in the window locks, Dad? But, you know, now I find it's just so lovely and cute that he'd be showing her that sort of thing. But yeah, you just have to, just keep talking about them. And I think, I think we live on through them sort of thing. I hug my kids a lot. My mum used to hug me a lot. And I tell Maddie that. I say, my mum was a big hugger, as we're having a hug. And I think you just carry on. You talk about like that. And I suppose, with us, we grew up with mum's mum, just seeing a black and white photograph of her. So you have to, you sort of conjure up your own image of them and what they were like, don't you?
Yeah.
If you don't know them. But,
yeah, it's difficult. Yeah. There's no... it's like grief, isn't it? There's no simple thing to it. It's always something tinged with pain that your children don't get to know them in that way. It's always, it hurts. But then, like you said, they'll do something that reminds you of them or you get to tell them a story and that's lovely. But yeah, it's never all good and all bad or just like fine. It's just something you live with.
And I waited till my late 40s to have my last child. I mean, the chances of me knowing my grandchildren...
But you're not going to die, remember?
Oh, that's true. Yeah, cool. I forgot about that. Thank you. Oh, yeah. You know, but if there's one message I could say here is have children when you're 18 years old. So that all the grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents know each other. And
I do. That's something that's... as people do these days, I had my kids quite late. And it wasn't until I had them that I was like, oh, fuck. Like, why didn't I...
Yeah.
I see now. I see why people used to do this younger because, one, the parents were hopefully alive and would be able to help.
Yeah.
And also they would get... Yeah, it sort of makes sense. But obviously that made sense when we were all living in rural villages in Ireland or Wales.
It makes sense to me now. I the idea that my grandchildren, if I'm around, I'll look like this just ancient old man doddering around rather than the virile, vital human being that I am now.
That was the most perfect younger sister cough I've got. Older brother, that was so... So with the book, I just wanted to talk about it briefly because I read it yesterday. I was hovering about saying yesterday. I read it yesterday. And I really loved it. I really, really loved it. And I started it thinking, I see. Okay, middle grade adventure book. Yeah. Like, and struggling with the riddles because I'm not a riddle person. But the way that you've got grief in there, I think is absolutely brilliant and really clever because it's sort of hidden but not in a horrible way, like it's not like when you hide vegetables in a sauce for a child and like sneak it in. It feels like it's just under the surface enough. How was it writing it for you, Stephen, and how was it reading it for you, Anita? Like, because obviously you recognize you're both talking, and as I have an older brother, and you've been through the same experiences, but your takeaway from those experiences is completely different. So yeah, lots of questions there. Sorry. So how was it writing?
I think when you write a book, you feel under pressure to come up with an ending, the beginning, a middle, and an end, and to solve the mystery, or to come up with something that. And thinking about grief. As I was writing, you realise that it doesn't end. Mm. You don't deal with it, wrap it up, and then go, well, I've done that now. It's not like an adventure where you get the prize or you get out of the, you beat the enemy. It's just there. And you have to try and deal with it as it comes along. So, I mean, there were so many things that came up writing the book. The idea that you can get it wrong, that you can you can do grief wrong. You know, the worry when you are grieving that somehow you're not normal. The idea that you might feel awful one minute and elated the next, you know, and your emotions are all over the place. And the idea that that perhaps is because you don't care enough, or you don't, you know, I should just be sad for 3 years. Mm. I should go around crying because my parent has died. We don't process grief like that. That's not how it works. It comes and it goes, especially when you're younger, I think. Those emotions come through you and then they go, and then they come back, and it's a sort of lifetime process. So I think having to write a book where it was grief is a sort of fundamental basis, even though it's a kind of, you know, funny adventure story, essentially. It's not a sort of weep fest by any means, but there is a sort of, you know, the background of grief that I just wanted to say to people, just try and deal with it as it comes along. Mm. And, you know, today you'll be dealing with something and you may deal with it well, you may not. And then tomorrow something else will happen. And just keep, you know, just keep trying. There's no right, there's no wrong, there's no successful. You're never going to beat it. You're never going to get rid of it. You don't want to get rid of it because, you know, you love them. You're going to miss them. So it's just to give yourself a bit of a break. And this concept of rooms, you know, just take it one step at a time. I suppose that was the sort of conclusion I came to in writing it, of like how to tackle it, because, yeah, you can't wrap it up. There's no end result. There is never an end result. Mm. There's only a continuing, ongoing. And of course, you know, that's what life is. You never get there. You never go, right, everything is now perfect. I can now start living my life. And it's very easy to think that. It's very easy to think if I get that job, or I can have those children, or that get that house, or, you know, then things will be, you know, no. Those things are temporarily having an impact, but life will just keep coming at you, and you just have to keep doing your best and don't give yourself a hard time. And you're not alone. There are people out there who've been through it, and you can talk to them if you want. And if you don't feel like it, so fine. You don't have to be someone who, you know, some people aren't people who have to spend days and weeks discussing every nuance of every feeling they've had. It can be very useful to talk to people, but there isn't a right or wrong way.
I liked that the two characters had very different approaches to the grief. I thought that was really helpful, especially for kids, because, and you know, everything we say that on the show all the time, like, it doesn't go away. It doesn't. And I think when I speak to people who are like 2 years down the line, when they sort of when they ask me, oh, I'm 20 plus years, they're like, oh shit, like what? Because they think, are you joking? I'm going to be dealing, and you're like, yeah, you are, but it won't be as bad as it is at that 2 year point. You know, like, that is a really, really, you're right by the bomb blast. But I think that's something we just need to normalize, that it's something you just carry with you, because that person will never stop being your parent, someone you loved, someone who cared for you. Their death hasn't changed that. And I think people just, like you said, they love the idea of an ending. They love the idea of, like, I get to this point and the grief will go. And it's like,
what do I have to do to get rid of it? What do I have to do to feel better?
To fix it. I think we're so looking for an answer and fixing. And that's what, I thought this book really captured that idea, and which is hard to explain to a child, because, you know, to them 2 weeks from where they are now is like, what? That's fucking ages away. And to be like, it's just something you have to go through.
And also that life can be fun and exciting and a wild ride as all this is happening.
Yes.
Life doesn't have to stop and then you grieve. Mm. I mean, it might do. It might stop for a while. But these things can, you know, it's just sort of, it's added into the stream of your life. You know, it's another tributary feeding into that river, and life is a mixture of all those things, and that's okay, and you can still laugh and have fun and be angry at times and be unpleasant and be caring and all those, you know, all that lovely complex stuff. It can all be happening at once. That's okay.
Yeah, I think that's, again, what people don't realise about grief till, you know, it happens to you. Of like, it's not one thing. It's a million things at the same time in your body, emotionally, physical, all of it. Anita, how was it when you read it? Like, did you feel...
Well, it went through a few drafts.
A few?
It went from...
7,000 drafts.
Each time it just got better and better. But, you know, there's the bit at the beginning when he thinks he sees his mum.
Oh, that really caught me, actually. Because yeah. I was sort of like, okay, yeah, kid's book. And then I was like, because we've all done that. We've all thought we've seen them. Yeah.
Oh, 100%. You know, just even now I think I see her as she would look now.
Yeah.
You know, but it's very Stephen, and it's, you know, it's got the tenderness with the comedy in perfect balance. And being brother and sister as well, we just share so much history and sense of humour, and, you know, the sort of Irish family thing of, you know, one minute laughing, the next minute crying in equal measure. I got it, and I thought he wrote it perfectly. He's great.
And this is on tape.
Yeah, he's got
on record. Can we rewind that bit, actually?
Yeah, I thought that, and I was wondering, maybe it's like the drawing of the character looks a bit like Stephen. There's an element of that, but then I was looking at like the girl, and I was like, I felt like Anita. I was like, was Anita a bit of a goth when she was younger? Like, there was something like I recognise as an ex-goth myself.
Well, I'm not really. I wasn't. Okay. I wasn't at all a goth. I was more sort of long, curly 80s hair, rocker, you know, or wanted to be. The description of the main character, Jack, was a boy with lots of curly hair, so I couldn't help but subconsciously almost draw Stephen. But Stephen does appear, as do I and my sister, in the book as a drawing.
I thought so. There's a moment, isn't there, where there's loads... Yeah.
Yeah,
and I thought that. Exactly. I was like, is that them? Having seen the press release. But yeah, I think...
That's the carpet,
the people
right.
Who got new carpets and can't stop sniffing them.
I really like them.
By the smell. Yeah, we're in that lineup.
Well, he will write, you know, there are 20 people lined up and they're all gradually getting taller. And I, you know, when I turned the page of that and I thought, oh, okay, draw one, take forever to draw one. Oh, number two... 18 to go.
thanks, Brian.
You're going in there.
But yeah, I think it's really, you know, it's really good to have these books that talk about grief in a way for children that isn't, so the rabbit has died, you know, like, because I think I know what I wouldn't have wanted to read. And, you know, I know you guys were a bit older, but still, you said, you know, you were young. It's, you know, that kind of young person mentality when things happen to you, it's like you don't want it to be dealt with in a kind of school video educational way, because that's what so much of it feels like. And I thought that was, you know, so successful about the book, is that it's in there, but it's not like making you sit down and talk about your feelings in a way that makes you want to...
Yeah, it comes out and their stories come out in fits and starts, and the feelings come out in fits and starts, and I think that's what happens. You don't just sit down and unleash all that you feel and all your pain. You don't even realise what it is sometimes for years. You don't know the effect it's had on you and how it's changed you or damaged you or, you know, altered you. It takes a long time for that stuff to come out, and it comes out in fits and starts and sudden realisations bits of denial.
You could just be, you know, there's a smell that's particularly evocative. You know, I go for a walk with my dog in the woods, and every now and then they must have a log burning stove in the woodman's cabin, and the smell of it just reminds me.
Where do you live, in Hansel and Gretel's house?
But the smell of it reminds me of Dad doing bonfires, and I just stand there with my eyes closed while my dog's, you know, terrifying squirrels all over the place. But it just sort of takes me back, and you know, and it's a lovely peaceful thing. I'm not sad about it, but it just can catch you sometimes like that, can't it? Just a smell of something.
Oh, yeah. And I think that you said fits and starts is a good description of what grief does to you and catching you. It's, And that's what I think all the time, when people say, you know, oh, it gets easier, which I think when you're at the beginning of your grief journey, you're like, what the fuck does that mean? But what it means is every time it does catch you, you've been caught before. So you're like, you know what it is, you know that it will pass, you know how to like find your way out of it again. And I think all that happens is you just get better at not running away from it. You know, that's certainly all I've done after years of like, run, grief is coming, fucking run. And now I'm like, oh, here it is. Okay, hi, like... It will pass. But yeah, that's, I think you just get better at going, oh, that smell is making me think of him. Mm. And so what I need to do is just close my eyes and remember it rather than like panic about it.
But yeah, grief. Yeah. I mean, after Mum died, I went to drama school, grew my hair long, wore leotards and jazz shoes, did modern dance.
It affects us all very differently.
Do. I mean...
That leotard you're wearing now is particularly
it's good,
gorgeous,
isn't it?
And sparkly.
It's lovely, yeah.
Thank you, lime green.
thank you both so much for talking to me. And I completely forgot to ask your mum and dad's names at the beginning, which I normally do.
Anita? Checking if you remember.
That's not their name. oh, sorry. Mary and James.
Mary and James. Well, thank you so much for talking to me about Mary and James. It was a pleasure. They sound like bloody good parents.
They were.
Thanks, Carriad.
Thank you.
As I said, Stephen's book, Escape the Rooms, illustrated by Anita Mangan, is available to buy now. It's absolutely brilliant. I definitely recommend it, even if you're not 9 to 14. You can follow us on the old socials at The Griefcast on Instagram and Twitter. Show was edited by Kate Holland. It was recorded remotely in, I think, mine and Anita's living room, and it seemed like Stephen's spare room, I'll be honest. It seemed a bit of a not a living room situation. And the music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. It's the last episode. I thought I'd make the outro different. If you've got this far, God, thank you. Not many people get to the outro. So if you have, this is just for you. Thank you so much for listening. I genuinely wouldn't be able to do this without you. So hi, and I hope you're having a nice day. I hope it involves chocolate. This show will be back in the autumn. And remember, as ever, you are not alone.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.